Succession number 28528, Reel 11.
And the fact that the low-powered 48 set was the only one available. When Black had fired off all his ammunition, Tom saw him pick up a rifle and burn it, climb out of his trench, and charge the Germans. Tom swung round, but was just too late in shooting the man who killed him. He then joined the small retreating remnants. Later, during a debriefing, the commanding officer noticed Tom's trousers were soaked in blood. He then realized he had a severe wound in his left knee. The action had been so hectic and he had been so hyped up, he had not noticed it before. An odd thing for me about this battle was that a man who acquired my book on Indelible Memories of the War sent to me his own war diary. The war diary had, in fact, he had at one stage sent it home by a friend, but the friend, for some reason, had been searched by the military police and his diary found, and for a month or so he was under threat of court-martial, with his commanding officer not quite knowing what to do, as he was so important to the regiment. Fortunately, the commander went on leave, and the man who took over seized the opportunity to give him a reprimand and scrub the court-martial. But in the diary, there was also something that might have been of great importance to those on Rentella. Apparently, a squadron was of tanks, or of the Lothians and Border Horse, was in fact ordered to follow them, their attack up and give them protection. But the squadron commander kept complaining about the difficulty of the ground and the fact that there were so many trees they wouldn't be able to see anything anyway, that eventually his commander and the commander in overall charge of the operation agreed that they needn't go on. So I can't help wondering what would have happened if the tanks had forced ahead and made it to where Blacker and his company were. Because if there'd been tanks there, since the German attack was solely by infantry, that might have indeed have changed the whole circumstances of that reverse. The fighting around Perugia had been particularly hard for us all. The diary of our 6th Armoured Division included graphic descriptions of the relentless fighting and steady flow of casualties at this period, as well as factual insight into the difficulties faced and the advantages the Germans had. The 61st Infantry Brigade entered Monte Rotondo at 0600 hours, finding that the enemy had abandoned the covering positions astride the road south, but experienced considerable difficulty with the heavy mining of all approaches to the town. A large number of casualties were suffered by 10th Rifle Brigade, particularly from box mines, which were found in considerable numbers. 26th Armoured Brigade continued with 16th Lancers in the lead. They were held up on the strongest enemy positions encountered for some time and could make no substantial progress in face of intense high explosive and anti-personnel fire from 88mm and 75mm self-propelled guns. 3rd Welsh Guards were unable to keep up with the armour owing to the extent of the demolitions and mines on the main road. These were kept under accurate HE and mortar fire from the enemy gun area. The feature which distinguished the day's operations was the encounter for the first time since Archie with a properly organised German defensive position held by troops of good quality, in this instance elements of 115 Grenadier Regiment and a battle group of the Hermann Göring Division. These German troops were supported by 914 Assault Gun Brigade in its first action, and it was these guns which were keeping the British advance under steady fire. We can therefore see that despite the overall pursuing nature of the Allied advance north, the units involved were still meeting with some determined resistance, well equipped and in advantageous positions. British casualties, although not heavy, were constant and represented a steady trickle of men killed and wounded. Lieutenant Philip Britton of 3rd Welsh Guards recorded in his personal diary that on 8th of June the battalion lost 4 of its 5 senior officers killed or wounded, including the commanding officer, in heavy German artillery and mortar fire. Britton's own platoon sergeant was killed in this shelling. The replacement for him was then killed by a mortar bomb just 2 days later, causing Britton to reflect that his platoon had lost 3 platoon sergeants in as many weeks and that the strength of the platoon had been reduced to half. It was a relatively simple matter for the German rearguards to hold the high ground and bring fire to bear on the main routes used by 6th Armoured Division. The extent to which routes were mined or otherwise blocked by demolitions further demonstrates the truth that all combat operations require not only strong combat units, but also an extensive and well-organized logistical organization supporting the advance. While much attention must focus on the advance of armored and mobile infantry units, it must not be forgotten that the Royal Engineers and the military pioneers were vital in these operations, undertaking the clearance of obstacles, particularly mines, the maintenance of the routes, and the preparation of river crossings. Without these units preparing the ground at every stage in the advance, both the foremost combat units and their supply, maintenance and medical units also would have been unable to move. An example of the difficulty encountered in the 2 days imposed on 6th Armoured Division over the 14th to 16th of June in crossing the River Nera, which required bridging under fire by the Royal Engineers. The provision of food, ammunition, fuel, fresh water, vehicle spares and medical facilities was a 24-hour-per-day necessity without which no advance could be registered. However, it was often these supply units, both on main highways and in concentration areas, that were being targeted by German artillery and mortar fire. The regimental history of 17th to 21st Lancers contains a detailed description of some of the difficulties posed by the terrain at this time. Italy is a country perfectly adapted for the use of demolitions and mines in the defence. It is seamed with a network of rivers and deeply eroded streams. Every mile of road contains bridges, culverts, cliffs, cuttings and embankments, all of which can be destroyed to hinder the pursuer. In this trail of destruction, to advance, even without opposition, was a major engineering problem. Between Cassino and Gothic Line, the engineers of 6th Armoured Division built no less than 50 bridges in 107 days. Each demolition was not only mined and booby-trapped, but covered by artillery fire, by tanks and anti-tank guns, and by small arms fire from infantry dug in nearby. Thus, the passage of a demolition could be a long process of unlocking the defences. First, a bridgehead would have to be captured, then the tanks and anti-tank guns had to be located and destroyed, then the mines and booby traps removed and the rubble cleared by bulldozers. A bridge site had to be prepared, a bridge brought up and then prepared in darkness. Finally, the advance guard would go through to find another similarly defended obstacle in the way only a few miles further on. Such was the daily prospect for us as we pressed on with little respite and increasing weariness. What a contrast with recent wars. In the first fortnight of the Iraq War, the great army of doom and gloom correspondents were forever talking of exceptionally strong resistance, unexpectedly tough fighting, troops bogged down, Baghdad described as another Stalingrad to come, and every single casualty described in great detail on TV for hours on end. Yet in that first fortnight, there were only around a dozen fatalities on land, sea and air combined, and over half of those were due to accident or friendly fire. In Italy, that would have amounted to the equivalent of one uniquely quiet day, if there ever was such a one, and our fighting went on for years, not a few weeks. But at least we had no doubt why we were fighting, nor did the civilian population at home, many of whom suffered far worse than have done our troops in Iraq. We had been infuriated by Lady Astor's comment that we were D-Day dodgers, a particularly stupid remark by a rather foolish lady. We had, of course, been fighting for 2 years or more, as in my brother Philip's case, indeed, from the start of the fighting in North Africa. We had, of course, been fighting for that length of time, while most of the D-Day army had only been training. The casino battles had also been much worse and caused far more casualties than D-Day itself. In Italy, it continued to be a case of a series of rivers and mountain ranges, with one grim little battle after another, and two more defended lines to be breached. But at least we were soon headed towards the last main fortified line, the Gothic, the last barrier before the Lombardy Plain. As the slow grind towards it continued, the three incidents that are most vivid in my memory all had elements of humour. I recorded, when we neared Florence, the main attacks kept going in on one side of the Arno, while we merely leant on the enemy on the other. As progress was made on the other side, the Germans on ours had eventually to react to straighten the line. The division had suffered a constant flow of casualties and was war-weary. So our successful plan was to put in limited night attacks when the troops opposite were anyway likely to be preparing to retire. When we were informed we had a new general commanding, it meant little to us. Except for a few exceptional ones like Monty and Alexander, at our level they were just names. What we did not know was that General Templer, who took charge, had just won himself a reputation at Anzio as a thruster. The gentle pushes up the Arno had all been infantry-led, and in our tired state, the last thing we wanted was to be energized unnecessarily to boost a reputation. The first indication of what might follow was when he was driven up to the front at speed, raising clouds from the dusty lane. He then ordered a daylight attack on greatly extended targets, having already arranged a barrage to begin so soon after that there was no time for proper patrolling or preparation. He then added to frontline annoyance by again raising a cloud of dust which attracted some shelling. As the company was being briefed, they received a very welcome message. Orders from Sunray being the battalion commander. Circumstances changed. Ignore senior Sunray order. Proceed as before. The circumstances were hilarious and very welcome to us, but not to Templer. In his hurry, he was held up by a guard's truck in a narrow lane. His driver's furious hooting finally made it pull over, whereupon the rear wheel ran over a mine. Out of the back sailed a looted piano, part of which fell on the general. To our relief, we never saw him again. In a letter I wrote home, I commented, "That may seem callous, laughing at a general's misfortune, but like many of them, he was a remote figure with whom we could not empathise, particularly in this case. So it was no surprise we had the usual banana skin accident reaction. There was little enough humour in our daily lives, yet it remained a case of laugh or cry, and our reaction was always to try and see the funny side. Typically, although we had suffered on occasion from the wildness of some of the American bombing, the response had been a jokey comment. If a German plane appears, the Americans and British take cover. If an American plane appears, everyone takes cover. Many German troops also exhibited a wry sense of humour. Near the end of the war, when everything was going wrong for them, their version was, if a silver-coloured plane appears, it's either British or American. If no plane appears, it's German. The same sense of black humour affected many of us after the massive bombing of Monte Cassino by American aircraft. That dominant mountain, with its famous abbey perched on top, was the most distinctive landmark in the whole of Italy, and all the more so when covered with smoke of bomb blasts on a clear day. Yet some of the planes still managed to drop some bombs on the headquarters of both the American 5th and the British 8th Armies, many miles behind the front line and down on the plain. Again, the reaction was laughter at the thought of the red flannel high-ranking officers having to dive for cover. There was then the strange incident of the pig. Our rations used to come up in boxes marked A to G. A was the favourite, as it included excellent tinned steak and kidney pudding. Far and away bottom of the list was C, with watery tins of so-called Irish stew. On the drive up from the dumps, or at the dumps, it was the A boxes that were first to go, with the C's the last to do so. We were getting fed up with C, and James decided he and I ought to help the practice scroungers we had to improve the diet. We had seen pigs in a nearby field, and after dark we set off on a pig-hunting patrol. I was to seize one by the back legs, while James applied a pad soaked in chloroform, which he had acquired from our medical officer. Unfortunately, in the dark, he kept applying the pad to the wrong end, so that the only thing being asphyxiated was myself. With all the pigs joining in the cacophony of sound as the pig I held kept squealing, that led to a hasty retreat. We decided to leave such operations to our rifleman experts in future. Along the way, our engineers were as versatile as ever. Their oddest job was a request from a keen fisherman company commander for a metal so-called rod with a wire line and a treble hook many times the size for fishing. In a mountain confrontation, there was a very small area between the front lines, and he wanted to recover a dead German's body close to his forward troops. It would have been certain death for anyone to attempt it. The unusual fishing rod was made and the body hooked at the third cast from behind cover, and the German unit opposite duly identified from the man's papers. A more amusing moment from them was when out clearing mines down a side road. They stopped work to watch a young German parachute engineer working his way back towards them, busily laying mines along the road. When he found himself surrounded, he was so taken aback, he readily told them that most of his company was mining the main road ahead and due to return to their line shortly. That allowed time for an ambush at the T-junction, with two speeding lorries of parachutists being shot up with Bren gun fire. It was during the drive to the Gothic line that the company lost my very respected Wickhamist friend and fellow officer, John Bodley, whom I've already mentioned. He was killed when his carrier ran over a single undetected mine. John had built a reputation in North Africa, fully confirmed in Italy, as the most fearless man in the battalion. Early on, his devil-may-care attitude to danger made him unnecessarily reckless on occasions. When he was sent on a company commander's course, the report included, "I can think of no one with whom I would rather be in a tight corner, and no one more likely to get me into one." In Italy, the first part remained true, but his judgment now was cool and calculated, making him an outstanding leader. His exploits in Italy were, as mentioned, he was wounded in the Cassino battle, were memorable. It was ironic that he should be killed by a mine when, like me, he had been on a mines course and learnt to give them such respect. Our company commander, Jim Lonsdale, well summed up Joan's character and achievements in a letter that is in that gift book in the archives. Bodley was very deceptive if you didn't know him. In ordinary camp life, he wore a sleepy air, but he was a complete contradiction when there was a job to be done. He had great reserves of energy and seemed quite tireless. If there is such a thing as a man without fear, it was he. Certainly he convinced everyone he had no nerves in his indifference to danger and cool judgment under fire. Throughout the Tunisian campaign, he did the work of two men, volunteering for every difficult job and taking the most appalling risks. In Italy, in the 3 days between crossing the Rapido river below Cassino Monastery and being wounded, he did some of his best work. He had steadied down since the end in Tunis and no longer took unnecessary personal risk. But he remained as courageous as ever, about the perfect leader. He also did one job that was absolutely brilliant. He was then hit while organising a diversion under shell fire and carried away on a stretcher making the V-sign. I have never known an officer so idolised by his men. When he returned, they were delighted and became twice the force they had been while he was away. When he was killed, it completely demoralised them. One man speaking for all of them told me they would rather it had been any one of them. As a civilian turned soldier, I was myself struck by the exceptional coolness under fire of some of the majority of professional soldiers, So it was no surprise to me that John had intended to make a career of it. That coolness was evident in some of us amateurs, but not nearly so universally. We too seemed able, for some of us, to ignore the whine of incoming shells and take decisions as unemotionally as if this was a sand table war game rather than the real thing. Most of my senior officers had this ability to an exceptional degree, coupled with a perennially cheerful outlook. Certainly Colonel Dick Fife did, as did Brigadier Adrian Gore. Gore, indeed, was sometimes far more optimistic than the situation warranted, as his cheerful outlook was always inspiring. At company commander level, my friend and future General James Wilson had it to a degree which made soldiering a natural career for him. So did my own commander, Jim Lonsdale, and Major Bobby Selway. Supporting us in command of 17th 21st Lancers, Colonel Dick Hamilton Russell was another who had an aura of calm in all he said or did in the heat of action. We always felt ourselves lucky to be with him and the 17th 21st, rather than the 16th 5th, or the Lothians and Border Horse, naturally and unfairly nicknamed the Loathsome and Bawdy Horse, who had been just as good, but who may have been just as good, but could not have been better. For me, the longer we went on, the more difficult it became to still jangling nerves and not let that interfere with rational decisions. The more experienced we were, the more knowledge you had of likely threats. ignorance was bliss early on. When a shell pitched 200 or 300 yards to your right, followed by another a similar distance to the left, you were pleased the shooting was so wayward. Later, your only thought was that you and those with you had just been bracketed, and a stonk was bound to follow, when often it didn't. Your instincts were also more sharply honed, and reactions sometimes too quick. Once, when leading a mule and donkey supply train up a mountain, I heard the whine of a shell closing on us and flattened myself to the ground. To my embarrassment, the rest stared at me in surprise. The sound had in fact been a donkey braying. My attempt to apply I had tripped won me no Oscars. That was why very experienced divisions were not always the best, as they had learnt too much and suffered too much. So perhaps General Templer, had had cause to try and energize us. For sure, we didn't like him for it, but as Monty once said, "I'm not here to win a popularity contest, only to win a war." I used to wonder if some people really were quite fearless, unlike the rest of us, or could they just conceal it better? Of one thing I'm quite certain. In comparison to me, some of them were either totally nerveless or had nerves of steel. When a shell pitched near me, I would stop in mid-sentence and there would be a slight jerk of the body. It was automatic, instinctive, and quite uncontrollable. But those just mentioned would carry on talking as if nothing had happened, and there would be no visible sign of any quiver in their body. The rest of us just had to ensure that it did not affect our subsequent thinking or action. When winter closed in and the war became generally static, I was home on my Python long leave. So as mentioned, I missed the Tossignano attack. I was told about it as soon as I returned to the battalion, which was now resting in the seaside village of Catolica. There I found I was now in command of the support company with its heavy machine guns, mortars and 4 anti-tank guns. To my surprise, my brother Philip's RHA regiment was now attached to our battalion to give supporting fire. Happily, Philip was too good a gunner for there to be another Tossignano type incident, which would of course have been especially embarrassing for me. The division had been exhausted when its winter attempt to break through to the Lombardy plain had ended in defeat on the Coriano Ridge. But with the spring came renewed hope, fresh energy, and at last improved equipment, since for the previous 10 months everything we got had been second rate and no new equipment, newly designed equipment, reached us. Even so, in the lazy days of Catolica, we did not envisage the rapidity of the German collapse. On our side of Italy, the first main objective was the Argenta Gap, opening the way to the plain and on to the River Po. The overall plan was excellent, involving a clever deception as to its main thrust and including false massive initial bombardment. At frequent intervals, the guns fell silent, as if heralding an attack. But as the Germans scrambled back to their firing positions, down came the barrage again. And that meant that when finally the barrage had indeed stopped, they were still down in their trenches as the attack went in on them. We also had a general who had a chance to use his division to best advantage and took it. We were not launched into attack until the Argenta Gap had been fully opened, and our sweep to the Po was then swift and unstoppable. As the opposition faded away, a troop of our tanks was rushed forward. For a time, contact was lost, and it appeared they might have been ambushed. Then, as I was listening in on a tank's wireless, I heard an excited young voice